Eat Geek Play Podcast, episode number 13, talking sorcerers and zombies with Mike Norton and Tim Seeley.
It was buried under a flask and a cut from the bottom of a glass. All this nonsense. Sense, common sense, consequence, indulgence in bourbon. This herb between city kings is disturbing. I can say the same shit from her. She be just sits silent, watching life just pass by in a blur. Ain't it funny? We can sneak into our lives in a stir over the perfect things to say and then just choke on the words.
Welcome to episode number 13 of Eat Geek Play Podcast. My name is Kevin Knight. I am the writer, editor, and contributor to eatgeekplay.com, the website where we talk geek almost every day of the week. So this week's episode is pretty special. I got into podcasting a long time ago, and one of the podcasts that I listen to religiously, and still to this day, is a podcast called The Crankcast. Now, The Crankcast is basically Mike Norton and this guy named Chris Crank sit around, talk about whatever just comes up. Nothing really in particular. It's kind of like a Seinfeld episode, you know, the show about nothing. It's kind of the podcast about nothing, but you're so enthralled with these guys' conversations. You're not really sure why you're listening to this podcast, but you listen to it every week, just wanting to know what's going on with these guys. Well, as the years progressed, Mike Norton started kind of blowing up in the comic book world, and a couple of his other buddies did too, Tim Seeley being one of them. Now, Tim, you might know as the creator of Hackslash, the story of a teenager named Cassie and her gigantic brute of a sidekick named Vlad as they hunt down slashers like you'd see in a horror film. It's a fantastic series that I hope you all read. The duo have also created a series called Revival, and they just put out the first issue of The Occultist, which is also created by Mike Richardson, the founder and publisher of Dark Horse Comics. So I got a chance to talk to Mike and Tim about things that are going on with Revival and The Occultist, and unfortunately, there's something wonky going on with my computer, and about the last 15 minutes or so of the interview just went completely to shit, and you'll get a little taste of it, but unfortunately we weren't able to continue the interview, but I did the best I could, guys, so I apologize. You know, number 13, all the other ones have been perfect. In case you missed it last week, I announced something pretty special. EatGeekPlay.com will be hosting the Podcast Lounge at the Long Beach Comic Con. Now, you're probably wondering, what the hell is the Podcast Lounge? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to take a space on the convention floor. Big, huge space. Put all sorts of couches out there, and we're going to be recording podcasts. You can come and hang out with us, talk to some guests, get some stuff signed. We're going to have exclusive stuff to give away to you. We're going to have gift bags that you just come up to the booth, and I'm going to give you a bag full of cool stuff. Now, if that's not enough for you, we're going to have live performances on the convention floor from This Wild Life, Rocom, Cosby Sweater, and Jedi Elvis. This is not something you're going to want to miss. It's happening November 23rd and 24th at the Long Beach Comic Con in Long Beach, California, at the Long Beach Convention Center. Let's run down the guest list of who's going to be there. You got Tim Bradstreet, Amanda Connor, Kevin Eastman, Ale Garza, Gene Ha, DJ Kirkbright, Mike Kunkel, Scott Lobdell, David Mack, Jim Mahfood, Jimmy Palmiotti, Derek Robertson, Mark Silvestri, Ben Temple Smith, Len Wein, and special guest Mark Wade. Who, guess what? Mark Wade's going to be on the podcast next week for a little bit. We're going to talk about the convention, we're going to talk about what he's going on, and we're going to talk about Daredevil, because we have to. So, you know what you should do? Go over to longbeachcomiccon.com, go get your tickets. $40 is going to get you in for a two-day pass. With that two-day pass, you get in a whole half hour early before everybody else. You get to go get all the good deals, and I might even have something cool for you at my booth. Maybe a free t-shirt? I don't know. I'm thinking about it. So make sure you go over to longbeachcomiccon.com to get your tickets. All right. What else? Oh, hey, so I got a bunch of new writers coming in on the website. I'm so excited about this. We're going to have content for days. Lots of comic book reviews. And, you know, I'm really happy that everybody's checking it out. And I want to just thank every single one of you that goes over to eatgeekplay.com, reads the stuff, makes some comments, whatever. It makes me feel like I'm doing something with my life, guys. So I really want to thank you. But guess what? This is the part where I beg. Please go over to iTunes and drop a review, a couple stars, something. Or if you're listening to this through Stitcher, leave a review there. Leave a review on iTunes. Wherever you're listening to this, just share the love. It really means a lot to me. This podcast is so much fun to do, and I really enjoy it, and I hope you guys are too. I would love to hear from you. So if you got something to say, please feel free to drop me a line, kevin@eatgeekplay.com. I think that's about it for now. So let's check in with Mike and Tim.
This was a book that I'd actually done for Dark Horse previously. It was a Mike Richardson idea, sort of like The Mask or the Dark Horse superhero line. So he'll like come up with something that he wants to see the comic. He actually dreamed about the occultist, as I understand it. He woke up from a dream where a man in a red cloak had visited him and said, "I am the occultist." And Mike woke up. This is totally true. I'm not making it up. And he got a cool design from Guy Davis and stuff. And then
that was no dream.
Yeah. So we did the first book about a year ago. It was like just a mini series. I think it was three or four issues. And then we did a couple stories of Dark Horse Presents. And I think, you know, in the end, it was sort of well-received enough that Mike wanted to do it again, Mike Richardson. But Scott Elliott, in the meantime, our editor there, had kind of gotten enamored with Mike's art on Revival. So he wanted to see what would happen if we put Mike on it, because the idea at its heart is sort of Spider-Man meets Doctor Strange. And Norton is a killer Ditko sort of inspired artist, so
I was going to say, this is pretty much, it seems like it's you guys' take on Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
I mean, in a lot of ways, I think that the initial idea that Mike came up with and pitched to me, Mike Richardson, was, you know, sort of taking that sort of, you know, 60s era comic thing with great power, great responsibility, but sort of updating it to a modern thing where, what if you had all of the power? What if you could do anything? And you had unlimited resources, but, you know, what would you, like, what you had a mission that you were supposed to accomplish within that, like, how much would that power corrupt or influence what you did in your everyday life, or, you know, sort of playing with the zeitgeist, I guess.
So what's it like working with Mike Richardson as far as this project goes now? Is he involved at all, or is it just like, here, do this?
He's pretty, I mean, once the idea is sort of going, he's kind of he's a little bit more hands off than I expected, which is pretty cool. He sort of called me, he wanted to do a conference call about this when we started, and I thought it was going to be like, I took out a notebook and I got, you know, got ready to take notes, and he just said, "All right, here's the notes I have for this next series." He said, "More action, more costume, more monsters, more romance." And that was it.
Did he say it like that?
Yeah.
Like the movie phone guy or something?
No, kind of. And that was it. So I was just like, oh, I put away my notebook because I didn't need to. I didn't need that. So yeah, it's pretty easy. And he, you know, he runs an entire company and a comic company and then a movie side, and also he's very tall, so he has a lot going on. So. He can give discretionary, you know, power to his short assistants, I guess. So
he just looks down on everybody and says, "Go do this."
Yeah, he's a delegator to the many people out there.
Many people.
So Mike and Mike are kind of on eye level then.
No, he's taller than I am.
Yeah, he might be taller. He might be the tallest. Mark Silvestri is the only one that's close, I think.
They may be around the same height. I don't know. Richardson was a ball player, so, I mean, that's...
Yeah.
He's got that basketball height.
So Richardson, Silvestri, and Shooter on a basketball team, it's almost like...
Oh, yeah, Shooter's huge, too.
Yeah, he's tall. I don't know. I don't know how good they are at their game, though. Richardson probably beats them.
He beats them. I don't think Silvestri's not very athletic. He's just handsome. So I don't know if it... You don't think you have to be athletic if you're Mark Silvestri handsome, you know?
I guess.
Like, why play ball when you can just be like, look at his face?
Do you think he does that?
Look at his face?
Look at my... I don't think he says it like that.
I'm not going to... I can't confirm the veracity of that statement. I can't say for sure.
So what do we have coming up with The Occultist? You know, first issue's out, second issue comes out next week?
Wow, that's really quick, it seems like.
Well, it's monthly.
It's been a month already?
I don't know.
It seems like it.
I've done messed my brain up, so I don't really know.
I don't think that it's been a month already.
Well, by the time this podcast comes out, maybe it is a week.
Oh, okay.
This is a five-issue mini. It is a contained story that's sort of like... We kind of treat, I think, the Dark Horse Heroes stuff, if it's not ongoing, we sort of treat it like movies, I think, to a degree. Like, each is a sort of self-contained story. So this is sort of the middle chapter, the sort of, like, the intro chapter was the first one we met this guy and find out how he got his powers, the origin story, if you will. And then this one is just sort of dropping right into the action and telling a story sort of about the corruption of absolute power.
Okay, so let's, with The Occultist, what did Norton bring to it that previous artists haven't?
Norton?
About 200 extra pounds.
I think the original was done very sort of in a realistic style. And I liked that artist a lot, but I think what we needed this time around was sort of just something really out there, because a large part of the story takes place in this sort of other crazy world, this very, you know, really imaginative, weird land called the Hemigistan, which is the, I can't even remember which language's word for purgatory. But all that stuff, you know, I think I needed a Mike Norton-level imagination to tackle that stuff and make it look convincing, but also really, really original.
I think the first series was much more... horror looking, and this one is much more horror superhero looking.
Yeah,
because I mean that's what it is. It's a superhero book. It's just
It has a lot of sort of the tropes of, like those. I think part of what Mike was going for at Richardson when he came up with it was sort of that there isn't, you don't see that sort of fusion of the superhero and horror tropes like you did in the 70s much anymore. And I think we're trying to do like a modernization of that sort of thing, you know, the sort of Tomb of Dracula or the, you know, Werewolf by Night or something like that. So this is kind of the magical version of that, I think. Norton is sort of more suited to big cosmic superhero stuff.
So
cosmic horror superhero stuff.
So with, in the first issue, there's the full page splash where you've got the occultist kind of going into that dream state where he's going into the woman's mind, You've got like the bumblebee riding a tricycle and
that's all in the script. I didn't make. I'm not that creative.
I was just gonna say, was that completely a Seeley mind then, Mike?
Yeah, he wrote all of that stuff, even the baby monkey riding on the pig.
Backwards.
But that's from an internet meme. So.
Which is from the first issue. It's called back to the first series.
You guys have known each other for a while now, correct?
Yes.
How did you guys meet? You met through Devils 2, correct?
Yep. I think, Mike, you were the first hired Devils 2. I know Crank was, but you were
Crank,
one of the first.
Yeah, Crank I don't consider a hire. He kind of just came with.
Yeah, yeah. So Mike got hired to be the graphic designer at Devils 2.
Yeah.
And I think I got hired to be an editor, actually.
Yeah,
So we both moved, he moved in June, I moved in August. And then so, I think we always, like right away we were like, oh, we like the same kind of stuff. Which, I think we both realized we didn't always share with Blaylock, who ran the company. So early on, we're like, we got to do something because we like the same crap. To varying different degrees, I think. But
yeah.
And so, hence the bromance of the comic book century blossomed.
I've never considered what we have a bromance.
Century. Well, yeah, I mean, I think part of it is just we were in the trenches of like a daily job. You know, when we worked at Devil's Due, it was like an office job. I mean, a weird office job, but it was an office job nonetheless. So I think we did a lot of stuff that, you know, we both saw like, okay, this is not how we want to do stuff. And agreeing on that meant to us like, let's try to get this to the point where sometime we get to do stuff the way we like to do it. So first thing we did was that Frontlines 18 G.I. Joe story where we pretty much killed the series.
I keep saying that, but we knew.
I'd love to say it.
The only reason why he even let us use that story was because he knew was that canceled. The series was canceled. I came to Josh with that idea like way early on, and he's like, no.
The idea being, Roadblock has a cooking show.
Shut up.
I told him that idea when I think he called me in Memphis, told me he got the license. And I was like, well, Roadblock would have had a cooking show. He's been on hiatus for all this time. He would have had a cooking show. And he's like, that's not what I was thinking.
Yeah.
But yeah, Tim actually wrote it because we have similar sensibilities.
I have to go back and dig that one up because I never read it.
Yeah.
It's
with Kung Fu Grip.
Yeah. Okay. And it could have been more sort of indicative of what we would be later in life, because it's got a pug in it who's lactose intolerant. We hit both you and me in that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, we made like a comedic Joe story, and we loved it. We thought it was fucking great. And then, you know, that kind of set us up to be, like, we didn't do a lot of stuff, but like when I hired Mike to do a Hack Slash story eventually, and we always kind of, you know, knew we wanted to do something. And then when Mike went freelance, I stayed at Devil's Due for a while, then I eventually ended up freelance too, and I hated being at home by myself, so I said, let's get a studio. So then, you know, now we have a whole bunch of people who have similar taste in the way things should be done.
Mm-hmm.
So now we make stuff all the time.
You guys started 4-Star Studios, and how many people are working on a 4-Star now?
There are 5 in 4-Star.
Yeah, there was 6, but we lost Chris Burnham to California. So screw that guy. But yeah, we've got right now everybody's actually working. Jenny Frizen, I believe, is watching another Prophecy movie.
No, she is watching Double Dragon. That's why I was watching it from over here. I was like, I cannot believe she is watching Double Dragon.
And she's got headphones on, so she can't hear us making fun of her. But Jenny Frizen works here. Sean Duff, who's a printmaker and designer and comic book illustrator. And Josh Emmons, who is a programmer and writer and works for Graphically, is here, and me and Mike.
That sounds like a pretty full office.
It's a huge office.
Yeah, it's a big
office.
It's
only full because we have tons of shit. That's the reason.
What's the atmosphere like then? Is it, do you guys just like sit around and help each other out with certain things, or be like, I don't know how to do this, or is it just a creative cesspool?
I asked him all the time to help me draw stuff, and he always refuses. So
it's usually followed it's by very, rub my feet is usually what it's followed
it's
by.
It's always a very unhelpful environment, yeah. If you ask me.
We had a friend of ours came in the other day to stop in, and he was shocked because we actually work. I think he expected when you come here, we'd just be like, "Wee!" But we actually sit and work all day. But yeah, there's... it's a fair amount of, you know, hey, does this look cool? What do you think?
Yeah.
Which is kind of why you get artists together, to get eyes on things. And then, you know, a fair amount of collaboration when we can do it, too. Obviously, Jenny does the covers for Revival. Sean designs all the Revival stuff. Mike and I do the story and art. And Josh just looks at us. But in the end, it's collaborative by nature.
He makes his opinion, though.
Yeah, he makes his opinion. He's our editor, proofer.
And then we say, you're crazy.
Is this how Revival came about then? Was out of the studio setting?
Definitely.
Yeah, because we had talked about doing something Mike was still drawing a lot of stuff for DC and kind of felt like, all right, I've done enough of this for a while. I want to make something up. And I wanted to do another Image book for a while. So we just kind of kicked around ideas and kind of combined. Like, I had two really different sort of ideas. And Mike said, well, put those together. And then he kind of kicked in some characters he wanted to do and ideas. And it was all done while walking to lunch, generally speaking. Our studio is not too far from a number of restaurants, but the walking to lunch is where all the magic happens.
Really?
Yeah, I think a lot of ideas come up. Some of them, most of them aren't worth making. Well, I think they're all worth making in a comics. They're just some of them are a little more ridiculous than others.
But yeah,
I can't even remember what a lot of them are.
I don't know, that one with the guy called the village person who's like Zartan, except he can only turn into a chief and a cop and a whatever. That was a weird idea. But no, there's just a lot of stuff kicked around. And I think when we hit upon Revival, we both said, wait, that's a thing. Like, that's something that we both are interested in possibly working on. And, you know, because when you start doing a creator-owned book, it's like a big investment. It's, you know, you're going to work for probably 2-3 months before anyone even knows, you know, before you even pitch it, you know? So you're really... there's a lot of lead time, and then every day for the rest of the time of that book, you're thinking about it. So it's definitely a big investment. But we've noticed that one sort of stuck with both of us.
Mm-hmm.
So is it how long between coming up with the idea and then going, okay, we've got to do this? Did it become a reality?
It moved fairly quickly, but not.
I mean, it's probably like, I think we started kicking around at the beginning of the summer. And then we had some art ready to go by the time New York Comic Con came around.
Yeah, October, where I had like half the book done. Almost.
Yeah,
like,
and then
seven pages at least.
And we pitched it to Image then, and they said, yeah, go.
Yeah, we just decided we were going to make it.
I think.
And then we showed it to Eric. Because he was surprised that we had as much done.
Yeah. And then by the time Christmas came around, I came up with the script and stuff sort of there. We were done by February, I'd say, and we published it in July. So it's like a year, basically. I mean, it's like a year from, hey, let's do something, to it's in stores, first issue.
Yeah.
Which is crazy to think about now. Obviously, we're doing other stuff in there, but, you know, Mike had a full-time drawing DC stuff before he...
Yeah.
While he was doing the first issue of Rival, I think, maybe even the second.
I think I was working on Youth and Revolt at Marvel.
I was doing
that at the same time.
I was gonna say, I thought that was after your DC exclusive.
Yeah. I finished Shazam Young Justice earlier that year, and I was working on Marvel miniseries.
Now, for you, Mike, this seems it almost seems like, you know, you were coming from doing like Capes and Cowls kind of thing, very, you know, superhero intensive stuff, and then to go to Revival, which is more cinematic and more of a you know, talking heads, more of a book.
Mm-hmm.
Was that something different for you? Was that more of a challenge?
It's definitely a challenge, but it wasn't something different. I mean, I started out making books like that. I mean, I did a small book for Slave Labor when I started out called The Waiting Place, which is essentially Revival without all the dead people. So
I was actually going to bring that up. Personally, I really enjoyed that book. I thought it was great. So,
thanks.
I also enjoyed that book, which was part of why I was like, I should utilize Mike for something set in a small town with real people, because he does that well.
Well, in that aspect, it was fun to do, because I feel like I can draw a lot better than back. I mean, that was 2000 when I did that.
Well, and that's what I was going to say, was with Waiting Place. It was really, I mean, that was your early career. I mean,
It was my second book I ever did.
Oh, so. Really? Okay. Yeah. So wait, was that before or after Argonauts?
It was before Argobots. It was right before Argobots.
Gotcha. Yeah. So
stuff.
So with Waiting Place, I really felt like I fell in love with that book, and that's you know, to me, I started following, you know, your career with Gravity and everything else, and. Uh-huh. When Revival came out, it's like, wow, this is a lot like Waiting Place, where it's more of that focused story, but it was like that kind of a detachment from what Mike Norton was known for with the superhero and action stuff and big splash pages and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you had to rope yourself back in?
No, I felt very natural doing it. It was a lot of fun, actually. I the thing was, you know, I started out doing those books, and I always had the ultimate, like, Sean McKeever and I both had the ultimate mission of making superhero comics, because that's what we always wanted to do. I think Tim was the same way. And you wanted to do superhero
comics. Yeah, not exclusively, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I wanted to do. And it turned out that, you know, when I came back to Revival, I kind of like drawing this stuff more. I mean, I feel like I'm okay at drawing superhero stuff, but it's not the most fun for me, as this kind of stuff is, you know. So it's funny what you learn, you know, over 10 or 12 years.
So do you feel like working for companies like, you know, Marvel and DC helps you get to where you are with Revival then?
Of course. I mean, everything I've done, I've learned from. So, I mean, yeah. I mean, I didn't get really hired to draw big slam bam stories at Marvel or DC anyway. It was usually stuff, for one thing, it was almost always younger characters.
Yeah.
And it was almost always, you know, the real life aspect of a story rather than, you know, the big event or something like that, which, you know, was fine by me. It made it more interesting for me. But that's why I would take the little kids books like Shazam and Young Justice, because they were so extreme in a way and you could play around. So I like to play on both sides of the fence, but, you know, I feel like I definitely have a wheelhouse.
I loved that Shazam book, by the way. It was such a fun book. Yeah, and did they collect that in a trade?
They didn't collect my issues in a trade. They collected the first half of the series. I think that's the only DC book where they just haven't collected the end of the series for some reason. It's not worth it to them to collect the... They collect everything nowadays, but they didn't collect that. So, yeah.
Maybe they'll put out that canceled cavalcade again.
Yeah.
In black and white. Big old phone book.
Yeah.
So with Revival, and how much of a collaborative effort is the book between you guys?
Well, I mean, the idea was Tim's, and I feel like it's Tim's.
It's mine with a lot of you in it.
Yeah, it's Tim. It's Tim's. If this were a stew, it would be Tim's stock, and I'm just adding some spices here and there.
Ew. Yeah, but all that Mike spice when
I'm adding spices
in your
here.
Soup or whatever.
It's like, hey, let's put some carrots in there too. That kind of thing. But it's all Tim's recipe.
Well, so. And the way that we do the book now, because it is hard to do a book with a huge cast like this, much harder than any of the other books I've ever written. We sit down and talk about stuff. I come with some plots that I want to do and some character stuff, and then we talk it out. It takes us maybe like 45 minutes to just go through and come up with like maybe the next 6 issues. I'll tell Mike kind of what I'm thinking, and we'll come up with some ideas, often over brews. And then I write everything down, I'll send it over to Mike, and we just kind of, you know, once it gets to the script, I do the script all by myself, but then I give it to Mike to say, hey, did I screw up anything? Does anything sound wrong? And then once, if he says it's cool, then we just go straight to art, and I don't even look at the art usually until it's all done, unless I walk by and see him doing it. Because I'm usually like, yep, good to go. It's pretty easy, but it's like, it's a book I don't think I could do myself, just because it's juggling so many things.
Right.
I mean, I can do hack slash by myself all day, though. I need a proofreader and everything, but I don't think I could plot and figure out stuff in Revival just on my own. I need a sounding board for it.
So with Revival, it's I love the fact that it's kind of Fargo meets Walking Dead. You know, I'm sure you guys get all sorts of weird, you know,
Hollywood pitches.
Yeah.
Used all these terms.
Yeah, we've probably
used ourselves. So don't.
You had mentioned it being having such a big cast. Is that what you set out to do? Was just, you know, introduce a really big cast and just see how they kind of come together? Or
yeah, Because it had to be a story about a town. I think that's what we said there would be main characters, but it had to be a story about a place. Because I think what the story is about is how people react to a situation in a community. Because a survival horror story is about how people, you know, most zombie stories are survival horror, and they're about individuals against the world. And our story had to be about these people having to come together to deal with a situation and how they dealt with it separately. And it's an unsurvival book, I guess.
So
I think it had to be a town. It had to be about different perspectives, you know, from government to the person on the street to the religious people to, you know, I think that's where we found our inspiration and interest in it.
And the book's definitely been a slow build. It seems like you guys are just touching the surface of what's going on with the book, you know, finally getting into why the revival, you know, what the relationship is between the revivalists and these ghost-like characters. Are we going to see more of that coming up, or are we going to really delve into the whole story of how this happened?
Yeah. I mean, there's a very delicate tightrope walk with how much information we dole out and in the story. And I mean, I tell this to Tim all the time. Once we do certain events, we're like on a countdown clock to the end. Because
I don't think anything's really been.
Because information is something that the reader definitely wants, but also it kind of once we give it away, we kind of show our hand in certain ways. So we're at a point now where, like you said, the mystery is well established now, and people feel like they know what's going on, but there are lots of twists and turns that are coming up and things that we're going to do that I know that nobody's expecting. But yeah, we've well established it, but in a lot of ways we're just starting in a lot of ways too.
Plus I think, like, if you just do a mystery story and you just make it about that, then I think you lose. I mean, that ends up being disappointing, I think. I think Lost proved, you know, that these characters were more interesting than their, well, that's because they didn't know what the ending was, but their characters were far more interesting in the end than the solving the mystery, right?
Yeah.
So I think part of what we wanted to do was, yeah, there's this big mystery story, and we want you to be interested in it, and we want you to put clues together, and we want you to have your own ideas of what's going on. But in the meantime, this is really about these people and their relationships. And, you know, I think we spent like the first 10 issues or, you know, first 9 really sort of introducing these people. And then I think the next 10 sort of really focus on their interconnectedness.
Exactly. And which I love about the book is you guys are really building characters in this, instead of just like, okay, it's, you know, this world full of people that have come back. It seems like you're slowly finding out exactly how these people are affected by the revival day. And both by revivalists and non-revivalists, you know, and essentially what these people are wandering around with no souls.
Yeah, pretty much.
And
don't give it away.
What?
Don't give it away. But
not everybody figured that out. So
yeah,
you know. If it's not apparent by now.
Yeah. It's funny to us because sometimes people ask us, like, you know, what that is, and we're like, well, it's it. We did say
we have pretty much told. There are people that still think it's an alien, so
yeah,
and that there's only one of them. So.
Yeah. I mean, but that kind of you know, the vague nature of that is probably to our advantage. You know, like if you're paying enough attention to catch that stuff, which you are, thank you. That's cool, and we kind of want that to be the case. But you know, we also sort of like other people's versions of what's going on.
Yeah.
Especially when we read reviews where people are like completely off base and they're like mad because their expectations of what they thought was going on didn't happen.
Yeah.
Like, well, that's kind of on you, not on us. But it's more, you know, that's part of the job, I think.
Yeah.
So Tim, when you're setting up a series like this, though, I mean, do you feel like there's a definite ending in sight with this? Or is it just like, okay, let's see how long we can stretch this out and bring a story and go further? Or do you feel like it's like, a Twin Peaks thing where eventually you're going to find out who killed Laura Palmer, and then either the series, you've got to completely retool the series, or...
No, I think it ends then. I mean, I think it ends when we get to the end of the story, which we knew was probably like 50 to 60 issues, and hopefully that's something we can do, you know, and sell books and get people to pick up the trades and everything. But that's kind of our intent, was always to get to the ending, and we know what caused Revival Day, and we know what final story we want to do. I think we're setting all that stuff up slowly, but they're all for a reason. So it's, I mean, yeah, I think people will be surprised that maybe they'll be surprised that we actually knew what we were supposed to be the whole time.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is not necessarily what the book is always about, but I think it's always behind the scenes. That's always lingering there.
With a book like this, it's got to be kind of hard where to keep people excited about it when you know that there's pretty much an ending at some point, you know, because it seems like it's kind of centered on just this particular town and not on a global aspect. And it's not like, you know, you have a new threat coming in every time. It's you know, just in this. You know, at some point with something like Walking Dead, you can go off and, you know, they can explore what's happening in Asia or something. But where this, you know, unless it reaches a global outbreak level, you know, you're contained to this one particular town. Do you feel like that's like a challenge, or, you know, that's limiting yourself or the series?
No, I think, you know, stories that don't end inherently sort of have a weakness.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, like, you know, there's characters you can constantly reinvent and do more stuff with, like, obviously, like Batman and Spider-Man, and but really you're just always telling the same story. You're just sort of doing it in a more modern, you know, way. So I think, I think we want it to end. We want it to be something contained, and that, you know, I don't know, do you care what people in China think about it in enough to have it be more than just mentioned? You know, I mean, I feel like it's sort of about the people directly affected, and we'll see that stuff, you know, but I think it's more like color. It's more important that, you know, it sort of adds to what these people are dealing with rather than going off on a side story about people not living in the place. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's because it's about a place, it has to wrap up in the place.
I always find it interesting where, you know, some people will start like say Lost, for instance. You know, I think they had a definite ending planned when they started the show, but with Lost, with TV, characters that you think are going to stay around don't, because actors are hard to deal with.
Well, no, I mean, there is a certain amount of flexibility though too, because, you know, like, there's certain characters in there that we didn't plan. It's impossible to plan for every page, every panel, I guess, is what it comes down to. I think you make the broad strokes and you make the big sweeps, and you know what your people are like, and you know what they want. I think that's the most important thing. You know what they want, and here's how this world they now live in affects what they want. So now the story becomes about these things getting in between that, you know, them and what their ultimate goal is. So, I think it's important to, once we've noticed, like, okay, this character people really like, or people get sort of annoyed when we go too far away from Dana and M. So we have adjusted while we've been doing it. You know, we've said, all right, let's pull back a little bit from the all these people for a couple issues and really focus on this particular aspect, because we can sort of glean that that's what the readers want. So we do a little bit of that. I think you have to. You just have to be flexible. You know, you don't. Your goal is ultimately to sell comics, so you got to be a little bit, you know, you can turn on a dime to make sure that people still love your book.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the Doomtree fan?
Both of us.
Both of us.
I used to live in Minneapolis, so I used to go to, like, Atmosphere shows and stuff. And then when I moved here to Chicago, I saw the Atmosphere do a show with the opening act of POS, and it blew my ass off. I couldn't believe it. It was like the greatest thing I'd ever seen. It was me and my brother. So then I just started bringing that stuff around, and I kind of converted everyone in the studio to Doomtree fans. We ended up meeting them sort of at a show. We went to go see Doomtree play, and I stayed after, and, you know, we ended up talking to them, it was Jenny and I, and Sims is a big comic fan.
Yeah.
So I mentioned to him that I was doing some comic stuff, and so we ended up talking to them about, we would love to put you guys in a comic appearance because it would just be cool for us. Plus, it totally plays into the story because we had that sort of, you know, we showed that on Em's wall she had Game Tree stuff, and then we wanted to explain, you know, how she ended up in this relationship with her professor. So yeah, that was super cool for us. Like, just as a nerdy sort of, I mean, you know, why do this stuff by on your own? You can't, unless you can do cool stuff that's just, you know, basically for you. And so
that was a cool, I mean, story-wise, it was a cool way that we dovetailed that into the, not to toot our own horns, but I thought that was a good way that Tim actually retrofit, because when I was drawing that M's dorm room, I was like, what would M have on her walls? Who would she listen to? And Tim said all these rap guys, and I was like, well, why would she listen to that? She's a like a sheltered white girl from central Wisconsin. Why would she listen to that? And then Tim explains it in the comic. Well, so I thought that was really kind of cool.
Yeah, it's that flexibility thing. It's like, sometimes you have to do something that doesn't make sense first so that you can come back and explain it.
Yeah.
That's a thing I've learned from writing ongoing fiction. It's like, sometimes you put something in that you're like, you know, Chris Burnham says, like, put a scar on his face, because then later you explain the scar.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
It's writing yourself into a corner on purpose.
Yeah, right, exactly, yes. You're like, I call it laying seeds. Yeah. you'll pick up later. And that one just happened to work out that we, you know, ended up talking to them. And I don't know, every time I see Dessa, I get like a bigger crush on her. So it's like, we gotta put Dessa on there. So
I mean, it really does make sense now in hindsight that she would like Dessa.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, that the whole point of Emma is she's a poet, and this professor is why she falls in love with him, is because he's showing her this outside world that she knows nothing about, you know, and so of course she falls for him.
Let's talk about Crankcast.
No.
Mike, how did the whole thing come about? Like, it seems like it's been this ongoing bane of your existence that you kind of hate, but somehow you kind of do it every week for, like, what, the last 6 years?
Kind of do it is the operative description there.
The thing was, I was listening to a lot of podcasts when I was working at home, and I thought they were the greatest thing ever. So I don't know how often I would go to Devil's Due when I wasn't working there. It wasn't very often. But one of the trips I made up there to talk to everybody, see everybody, I told Crank, and I'm sure I was, like, annoying, that I was like, oh, guess what? I listen to podcasts now. They're awesome. You should make one, Crank. Well, actually, I told Sam that him and Liz should make one.
Our comedian friends.
Because I thought they would be hilarious. And then I told Crank that he should make one because I knew Crank had the ways and means to do it because he records his music all the time. And he said that I had to be on the show. And so I'd been on a couple of interviews online, and I was like, oh, well, that makes sense. I could constantly market my stuff online if I had my own show. So, I did that. And after a while, it becomes a big hassle and pain in the butt.
A chafing.
Even though I did nothing. Crank does everything. That's why it's his show. He does everything.
You're sort of the crankier Ed McMahon.
Yeah.
Now.
So he called, and it couldn't be easier now. He just calls me now. It used to be I'd have to drive over to his house.
I liked it because I was on a lot of the earlier ones, and I liked that we had to go over to a place
and do
a recording. Yeah. And now the hard part is he calls me, we're at the studio, and half the time I'm like scurrying to get like corrections done on a Batman script or whatever.
Well, you have your headphones in, you're writing. You don't even hear.
Yeah, I can't talk and write at the same time. Just can't fucking do it. So like lately it's hard to do it. Like, but I liked it when we would sit around and drink Budweiser at Crank's house and do the show. I love
that. Yeah, that's right. He would always have really cheap beer.
Yeah, crappy beer. And those were fun, man.
Yeah.
But it seems like it's kind of one of those things where you're forced into doing it now, Mike. And
well, at this point, and Crank and I both have this in our personalities, where once we go past a certain point, we just want to keep doing it to see how long we can. We have very high tolerances for monotony. And I think we just want to see if we can do this essentially until we die, I guess, because nobody else has. So
that's kind of amazing.
We kind of
hopefully you'll die on the Crankcast.
That's like, what I was gonna say,
or something.
Yeah,
you just like say,
and
like,
it will be me complaining.
Yeah, you'll be like,
it's like, I really hate being up. Oh God,
yeah. Why'd you have to make me record this? And then
a life in podcast.
Yeah, I'm complaining about the connection or something. It's like, I hate this show. Every goddamn die. Yeah. Die. I actually say die. As you, die.
You're like, oh, it's crossing wires, my EKG. Oh, look at the
Yeah. But yeah, that probably would happen.
Mike, it always seems like you're shocked when somebody tells you that they listen to the show, though.
I used to be. I'm not so much anymore because a lot of people kept doing it. But I also do. I do apologize every time, because I do. I think that that's an hour out of your week that you spent listening to us essentially do nothing.
Well, I think it's like Seinfeld. It's about nothing, right?
Well, I know, but I don't do that. I don't listen to people do nothing.
Well, I think because I know people in here in Chicago that listen to Crankcast, Crowley and friends of ours who listen. It's like, I ask them sometimes, well, what do you like about it? And they're just like, I don't know, it's like sitting around listening to your friends talk. Like, I think that's kind of unique. I mean, you know, and Cranky's a weird dude. You're a cranky dude. And every once in a while, Josh is a super opinionated dude. You know?
That's right, that's true.
So, I don't know. Kind
of argy dude.
I mean, from me being the outsider, I think the one thing that I always enjoy is, you know, hearing you guys talk about, like, Revival, you guys had talked about for a while, like, oh, we're working on this book, or you drop hints about it every now and then, and all of a sudden it's like, hey, we got this book out, or we're working on this book, and so it's almost like you can track the progress of what you guys are doing, and you know, your careers almost. I feel like I've watched your career come about, Mike, through the podcast. Like I feel like there's this weird connection almost where it's like that, it's like that I don't have to Howard Chaykin or, you know, somebody like that, where it's like
that's probably why there's, if we have an audience, that they're, you know, that there's any kind of audience, and why we get categorized a lot of time as a comic book show, even though we're not really. It's that kind of,
well, it's your life, right?
There's that kind of connection there, and people will listen just to hear, like, oh, did he meet Bendis or something like that?
Well, I mean, Crank is probably the only letterer who has people consistently ask. I mean, he's consistently asked about it at conventions. Like, every time I go, it's like, do you guys bring Crank? Like, letterers do an amazing job, but they're somewhat underappreciated. And certainly, I've never had anyone else ever ask me where a letterer is.
Yeah.
You know, so he's made a character.
Had a couple people in New York ask him about him.
Yeah, totally.
He's the most asked about man at conventions that never shows up.
Well, that's certainly true.
That's probably true.
We saw him at a convention in his own town. That happened for a day. Yeah. maybe a day and a half.
So he does exist.
He does. Oh, yeah, he does. That's actually a question I hear a lot.
Whether or not Crank actually exists?
Yeah.
The amount of work you'd have to put in to create a Crank.
I was just going to say, I don't think there's... I think they broke the mold when they made
Crank. Well, he does a pretty good job of staying off the grid. I mean, it's kind of hard to find a picture of him online. Because I tried, because I wanted to make a big giant cutout of him to take to conventions.
Oh, that's awesome.
But it's hard to get a picture of him, and I didn't want to ask him because he wouldn't give it to me if I asked. So... He's pretty good at keeping himself hidden for somebody that pretty much only exists on the internet.
The other thing I like about that show, because if I had a podcast, I would be constantly pressured, I'd feel pressure, and would be stressed out about making sure it was always entertaining. And
well, that's kind of why we have that fucking attitude now, is because it is stressful.
Yeah. I just wouldn't be able to let it go. It would kill me. I'd be like, and now for the variety hour, like I'd be calling and...
Yeah, we can't.
I'd have to. It would drive me insane.
But it seems like, Mike, it's really kind of helped your career as well.
I think so. I mean, as much as I complain about it, sure. I think being on the internet in general helped me out early on, the podcasts that I was on. because I was on a bunch of other podcasts too.
And then
I think that definitely helped.
Like, part of the job is to be a, you work in entertainment, you have to be a personality. You have to be
now.
Yeah, now you have to be. I mean, there's so many awesome artists that come from that generation just before us that don't that don't exist that way, and you know, they don't get recognized the way they should.
Yeah.
Oh, it's hard because you know, you either completely get it or you completely don't. But it also seems like that's where Battlepug came out of, was Crankcast.
Sort of, maybe. I don't know.
They're connected.
I'm sure they're...
Well, iFanboy, it definitely comes out of, right?
Yeah, the same trajectory. I mean, it definitely has to do with podcasts. So, yeah. I mean, that... I mean, yeah, Battlepug is directly related to iFanboy. And that, I mean, that goes back to the whole being on other people's podcast thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
So, were you shocked with the reaction that Battlepug got when you decided, like, hey, I'm going to do a weekly comic?
I don't know if I was shocked. I was very appreciative and very happy about it. I didn't think that it would do very well, and technically it still doesn't do that well. I mean, it doesn't pull in a lot of numbers like a lot of people think, especially for a popular web comic. But I was very happy with how it turned out, or how it is turning out. It's still going on, I think. Yeah,
I mean, you're on a regular schedule with it
currently. Yeah, I mean, that goes back to the whole Crankcast thing. I would have done that schedule whether or not anybody was looking at it or not. I had it in my mind that I was going to do this certain amount of story, and that is my end goal. So whether or not, if people stop looking at it tomorrow, I'm still going to do the next 300 pages or whatever it is I have planned.
Nice. Now with Battlepug, do you feel like it's a challenge to get that done every week, and as yes. both a writer and an artist?
Yes, definitely.
And
it's extremely difficult sometimes.
It's got to be like kind of just like that, you know, because this is a whole different side of Mike Norton as far as the writer go, you know, writing.
Well,
Mike Norton, and
it's easier than I thought, but more difficult than I wanted to be. How's that? You know, it's this sort of thing comes very quick to my mind, writing what I would call a real story like Revival. I don't know if I have that in me, but the Battlepug stuff comes very easily. And it's not like I'm doing a weekly gag strip where, you know, Wednesday comes around and I'm like, oh, better think of a strip. I know what's going to happen. So that's easier for me. But I draw it. And that's how I write it. I just draw it, and then I come up with a script later.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I do not understand how you do that.
I don't understand. So, Tim, you being an artist as well, are you paneling things out as well as in writing along with that? Or when you do the art side of things, you're the artist, and on the writer side of things, you're the writer?
Yeah, I mean, they're totally separate. If I write a script for myself, I still do full script.
Really?
Yeah. Just because I can't...
So there you go. That's what was left of the interview with Mike and Tim. I don't know what happened. Something with the recording device that I was using went all sorts of haywire. And you don't get to hear about all the stuff that's going to happen in Revival. And the huge conversation that we had about Tim writing the weekly Batman series coming out next year with Scott Snyder and a bunch of other amazing writers. Tim is actually writing a Batman book with Scott Snyder, and it's on a weekly schedule, and it comes out next year. So that's pretty cool. He's also bringing back Evil Ernie with the relaunch of Chaos Comics. So look for that next year as well. Mike's got Battlepug every week. If you go to battlepug.com, you can get your online comic book fix for free. And let me tell you, you're going to love Battlepug if you've never read it before. It's talking pugs and a barbarian. What more could you ask for? So go over to battlepug.com, ihatemike.com, timseely.com. Follow both of them on Twitter. You can check out their studio at 4starstudios.com. And go subscribe to the Crankcast if you haven't already. It's a lot better than this podcast. I can guarantee you that. Oh, I hope so. Yeah, it is. It's better than this podcast. I really enjoy it. You'll laugh a lot. Let's see, what else do I got? Next week, Mark Waid. I'm so excited for this. Can't wait. Long Beach Comic Con, November 23rd and 24th. November is crazy month. If you're going to be out at the conventions, there's Kamikaze, there's D-Con, and Long Beach Comic Con. And there's other stuff going on all throughout November. You can head over to eatgeekplay.com. Check out our events calendar, where we have a huge list of things that are going on in Southern California. All sorts of signings, conventions, board game tournaments, video game tournaments. The list just goes on and on. Go over to eatgeekplay.com and check it all out. So let's talk geek next week.